chest. The crane rose, straightening its articulated arm, and slammed down on Napalm's head. Sparks flew from Napalm, and liquid fire gushed through the cracks and ran down like blood. Napalm fell to his knees. His back was a tornado of stone and magma as he was slowly, relentlessly ripped apart. And then, all at once, it no longer mattered. Chapter 25. Something Worse. The Mother Rock had sunk deep, deep under the Pacific. It had not stayed long, but in the time it was there, it had encountered many amazing life forms. And when it was raised from the ocean floor, it had retained DNA in its little cracks and pits and holes. A cornucopia. A giant buffet of some of the Earth's strangest DNA. The Mother Rock, itself a tiny fragment of the original planetoid, was suffused with an alien-engineered virus of incredible sophistication, programmed with a sort of instinct that could give an impression of conscious will. It absorbed DNA and used it to play with other life forms, mixing and remixing, like a malicious DJ. So, when Vincent Vu ate some of the Mother Rock, he ingested not only the alien mutagenic virus it carried, but also the DNA of two of nature's stranger creatures, Leptosteria cyqualis, a starfish, and the more boringly named sea star-associated densovirus. The Leptosteria cyqualis had five arms, each coated with spiny armor. Beneath each of the five arms were dozens of tiny tube feet that moved the starfish. Most of its vital organs were in the central disc, the nexus of the five arms. It was one of nature's more harmless creations. In its natural state, for in its natural state it was so small, it could rest comfortably on the pad of a man's thumb. But matters of scale were no problem for the Mother Rock's own virus. The Mother Rock's virus was fascinated, in a purely mechanical way, by a very, very distant relation, the densovirus, as were a number of human scientists, for the densovirus had a very strange and gruesome effect. It caused sea stars to tear themselves apart. It caused starfish to amputate their own arms. One arm of an affected starfish would simply start to walk away from its body. It would motor its tube feet and pull until it began to tear, until the skin ripped and white meat appeared. It would pull away, marching on its hundreds of tube feet, each a tiny white cylinder ending in a sucker, and it would keep pulling as viscera separated and strings of gut were stretched to breaking. The alien mutagenic virus found that the densovirus fit its profile for something useful. Vincent Vu had first morphed 36 hours earlier. Then he had filled his mother's cabin so quickly that he'd had to squeeze out into the corridor, which itself was too confined, so he had simply started pushing down bulkheads and then bursting through decks, spreading his growing bulk through the ship. The captain kept a pistol aboard for emergencies, but he died before reaching it. The six security people came at the morphed Vincent with disciplined but harmless fire, and he had killed them as well. His mother had pleaded with Vincent, begged him, told him he needed help, and he had crushed her beneath one massive arm, tube legs tearing her dying body apart. Vincent Vu had felt bad about that, but he'd had no choice. She was trying to stop him. And the new voices in his head, the ones that spoke without words, had seized on his delusion and encouraged him to believe that yes, he was Abaddon. Yes, he really was Satan's angel. Yes, he was being sent to purge the earth of verminous humans. Vincent had never been the most stable of humans. He'd already listened to the mad voices in his head, the voices of the most dreaded of all mental illnesses, schizophrenia. But now, he had acquired shocking power and a whole new set of voices, and he had murdered his mother. The unstable, deteriorating Vincent was now beyond mere instability. He was, in short, stark raving mad. Stark raving mad and terrifyingly dangerous. Vincent Vu morphed was a creature of five massive, thick, crusty, bright red arms. He filled the Okeanos. At the center of this starfish body, rising like a flower's stamen, was Vincent, or at least Vincent from the waist up. He appeared almost to be riding the great starfish. Where Vincent's human body melded into the starfish was a sort of girdle of tentacles, another gift of aquatic DNA, very much like Drake's whip hand, but thinner and twice as long, and each, as he had discovered to his delight, carried a corrosive, acidic tip. During the long trip to the port of Los Angeles, Vincent's starfish body had torn itself apart, arms walking off on their own. But as the densovirus caused him to tear himself apart, new legs grew quickly to replace the departed sections. And the runaway arms, driven to tear themselves free, were still mostly under the command of Vincent Vu. Those runaway arms had become his servants, his henchmen. They slithered and crawled throughout the ship, smothering crewmen to death. And those were the lucky ones. The less fortunate ones were disassembled, piece by piece, square inch by square inch. Some had taken hours to die. Even less lucky crew members were absorbed. The arm sections crawled over the backs of screaming men and women, penetrated their bodies with their tubular legs, grew inside the helpless victims, and made puppets of them. Twisted, scarred, disfigured puppets. One such puppet had concealed his disfigurement with a hood and had been the one to tie off the ship. But the need for concealment was past. The ship was under attack by a powerful monster who was after the Mother Rock. Vincent could not allow that. He was too big to simply emerge from below decks. His red arms extended down corridors into engineering, into the labs, into the sleeping quarters, into the holds. From the tip of one leg to the other, Vincent Vu now stretched 140 feet. For the last 6 hours, with land in sight and the Navy handing escort duty over to the Coast Guard, Vincent had been in complete control of the ship. His puppets had said all the right things over the radio, had done all the right things bringing the ship into port. Vincent hated the idea of leaving the ship, but napalm was leaving him no choice. So he squeezed himself and pushed his human form up through the hold, the better to see the situation. He was, at first sight, a thin, bare-chested boy. And then, having seen napalm, Vincent simply pushed upward with all parts of his great, extended body. The upward pressure buckled the decks. The few remaining bulkheads broke free from decks with a series of crunches and snaps. The superstructure tilted. The sides of the ship bulged outward. Finally, with the ear-splitting noise of steel being torn like so much canvas, he began to truly emerge. A red arm rose from the foredeck, an elongated triangle, 2 feet waving. Another erupted through the side of the ship. A third swelled within the superstructure, bursting portholes and hatches. The big golf ball that sheltered the radar crumpled. The legs of the mast snapped or bent, and the golf ball smashed down onto the pier. A fourth leg rose behind the container that held the Mother Rock and wrapped itself around the prize. Napalm took a step back and stared in blank astonishment. But Peaks recovered quickly and recognized the threat. This new beast was after the rock too, and Peaks meant to have that rock for himself. "Fascinating," Peaks said with his monster's voice. "I'd love to study you, but sadly, I have to destroy you." Vincent's answer was a soft but defiant, "Try." Napalm sprayed fire at the crusted leg cradling the container. The leg drew back, dropping the heavy container onto the deck with 2 loud bangs. The noise of the container hitting the deck, and a split second behind it, the deeper thump of the Mother Rock slamming around inside the container. Napalm bounded over the side, crashing down in fire and smoke on the deck of the Okeanos. But that deck was being torn apart, with great jagged rips opening, as if the entire ship was exploding in slow motion. Napalm rained fire down into the gaps and was rewarded with a very human-sounding scream. Then, from the direction of the bow, an arm no longer attached to Vincent's main body came at Napalm, trailing its ruptured viscera, running on tubular legs like a red torpedo. Napalm turned and blew flame at the arm, but it did not stop. It burned, but it did not stop, and Napalm felt, rather than saw, a second detached arm slithering toward him from the starboard side, crawling up and over the rail like a sea monster rising from the water. "Burn!" Peaks roared, and he spread his liquid fire everywhere. It rolled across the deck, blistering the paint, seeping down into the holds, lighting up anything flammable, food supplies, scientific gear, specimens, bodies, the ship's cat, and Vincent. But Vincent's detached arms continued their advance on Napalm, their tubular legs burning and regrowing, burning and regrowing. They marched like fearless warriors through walls of flame, over blistering magma. They burned and smelled of fish. They burned and sent up an oily smoke. They writhed and twisted and were consumed, and yet kept growing. Impossible. The scientist in Peaks, the rational mind that still worked feverishly beneath the animal rage of Napalm, could not believe what it was seeing, could not imagine that anything biological could so ignore its own destruction. It wasn't courage. The sections were mindless automata, indifferent to their own survival, driven by the will of the thin boy with the glittering eyes. The ship was sinking. One of Vincent's legs had pushed through the wrong part of the ship, and water was gushing in through a 5-foot hole below the waterline. The deck, already a crazy quilt of twisted metal and fire, tilted as the bow began to settle. Vincent did not feel the agonies of his detached sections, but he felt a dull pain from those parts of his core that burned, dull pain being all his starfish nervous system could convey. The pain was tolerable. What was not tolerable was the fact that he had been forced to let go of the box and its precious contents. Furious and afraid, Vincent now began willfully ripping the Okeanos apart, tearing off great slabs of steel and hurling them at Napalm with shocking force. A 2-ton segment of deck hit Napalm like a sharp-edged frisbee, cutting deep into him, spilling a gusher of magma, and causing Napalm to howl in pain and fury. On the wharf, Dekka and Armo, Shade and a demorphed Cruz, stood watching in confusion. "Which one do we fight?" Dekka asked. Off to their right, Drake seemed equally nonplussed. He stood there, whip arm twisting in agitation, as his body regrew melted flesh. The Coast Guard was less indecisive. They were getting frantic, screamed orders from DeMarco on the radio. "Sink the ship! Sink it now!" The Bofors opened up at point-blank range, firing into the port side of the already sinking Okeanos. Cruz covered her ears with her hands. The noise was staggering, ripping steel, the furious sound of a fire running out of control, the bam-bam-bam-bam of the Bofors gun, the thwack-thwack of the helicopter, all punctuated by Vincent's shrill screams and the rumbling roar of Napalm. The Okeanos, or what was left of it, settled into the mud. Its main deck was now well below the level of the dock, its superstructure looking like a tin can after someone had dropped in a cherry bomb, shreds and tatters hanging. And now, no longer hidden by hoods, nightmare creatures leaped onto the land. They looked like human beings hugged from behind by giant red centipedes. And as they advanced, they sprouted tendrils like worms, tendrils that grew from human stomachs and chests, whipped furiously like electrocuted spaghetti. "You're Dekka," Shade Darby said, slowing her speech. Dekka shot her a surprised look. "Do I know you?" "Shade Darby," Shade said. She pointed at the advancing meat puppets and said, "I've got them." Vincent's human meat puppets were quick, but not to Shade. The whipping tendrils were bewilderingly fast to a normal human, but not to Shade. She unwound the thick rope that had been used to tie the Okeanos off to the dock. The end of the rope was burning. She whipped the rope around over her head, not at her maximum speed. The rope would have come apart, but far faster than a human could. Then she smacked the rope end into the nearest meat puppet. The impact slammed the creature so hard, it careened off the edge of the dock and fell into fire. She went after the second of the puppets, and this time whipped the rope around its human legs, dropping the creature to the ground. She ran up on it, twisted the rest of the rope around its waist, cinched a knot, held on tight, and gave it a burst of speed. The meat puppet split apart, two pieces falling with wet sandbag sounds. Two more of the meat puppets closed on her, recognizing that she was the immediate danger. One shade dispatched by hurling a section of steel mast like a javelin. It skewered the foul creature, but then something struck Shade's neck. She jerked away with speed that saved her life, but barely. The place where the tendril had touched felt like someone had jabbed a cattle prod deep into her neck. Shade bolted, ran, then slowed. Her limbs had gone heavy. Her insectoid legs had lost their spring. The world around her sped up as she slowed. Poison. She began to demorph, but instinct warned her not to, and she stopped, fearing that the poison within her would not be eliminated by resuming her human form, suspecting that out of morph, the poison would kill her. She folded her legs beneath her and sat hard on the dock. Breathing was coming hard. Her vision blurred and her head swam as the dock turned beneath her. Nausea rose in a wave. A meat puppet advanced, and it was all Shade could do to keep it in sight as the whole world went sideways and slanted and prismatic. Tendrils whipped the air, and in seconds would stab her again and again, filling her body with enough poison to kill any living thing. Water. She had to reach the water. Get away. Her legs were as awkward as stilts badly attached to her body. Her hands were better, and she clawed at the dock, hauling herself inch by inch. But there, just before her, a pool of liquid fire. Too weary. Stop right here. The meat puppet advanced, as all around Shade Darby raged a battle like nothing the world had ever seen. So much for being a superhero, Shade thought, as the meat puppet and its flails loomed closer. Chapter 26, Innocent Bystander. One person on that dock had ever been in many a fight to the death. Only one had come near to death so many times that she and death were practically on friendly terms. Shade had fought, but only Dekka was a true combat veteran. Her eyes surveyed the scene. Armo, morphed again, stood wet at her side. The Shade Darby person had knocked out two of the meat puppets, then fallen. The shapeshifter, or whatever she was, Cruz, was human once more, crouching in fear. The simple fact was that they did not have the power to beat Napalm, and they certainly did not have the power to beat the incredible beast tearing itself free of the ship like a man fighting his way out of a paper bag. Armo, Dekka said, I suggest retreat. The white, furred berserker glared at her through slitted eyes and made an animal roar. But then, in a more human voice, he said, Let them fight it out. Shade, Cruz cried, pointing. Dekka trotted down the dock, aimed, howled, and fired. The meat puppet flew apart, as if it had swallowed a bomb. Cruz ran to Shade, and Dekka rejoined Armo. Where were we? Dekka wondered aloud. Thinking about running away, Armo said. Dekka nodded. Let them fight it out, and we take on the winner. Yes, that was the logical thing. It was the unemotional thing. Two vastly powerful enemies were fighting each other. She had a vague memory of a quote, something about not interfering with your enemy when he's making a mistake. But logic was not everything. There was also hate. Dekka turned toward Drake, who seemed transfixed by the great red beast now grappling with Napalm, and shouted, You! You and me, Drake! You and me! Drake's eyes glittered. He smiled. My pleasure, you fat black dyke bitch. Drake ran at her, fearless as ever, stumbling slightly with his limbs not entirely regrown, whip hand already sailing through the air. They had fought before, back in the phase, but Drake had never faced this Dekka. She raised her hands, screamed in his face, and Drake disintegrated, reduced to a squall of bloody bits flying through the air. In 2 seconds, he was gone. Aside from a stain on the dock, Dekka nodded, satisfied, but not so naive as to believe he'd been truly destroyed. It would, however, take him a while to put himself back together. And damn, it felt good. Now, Dekka and Armo started backing away, but Dekka found it hard to disengage. Partly, her veins were drenched in adrenaline, and that adrenaline was urging her to take one more shot at either napalm or the creature on the ship. But there was more to her reluctance to retreat, for the Dark Watchers were not happy with her prudence. Shushed but urgent whispers in her brain egged her on, demanding she fight, fight, fight. It was all she could do to force herself to step back, to take another step. And now there was a black kid, face wild, rushing past her to where Cruz knelt beside a stunned Shade Darby. Then, with a Herculean spasm and a crashing, splintering noise, Vincent surged all the way up and out of the wrecked ship, heaved his bulk onto land, once more holding the container aloft like a prize with one red arm, and surged straight at Napalm, who backed away on the dock, leaving flaming footprints behind him. "Get her out of here!" Dekka yelled to Malik. Napalm vomited a gusher of magma at Vincent, and the red flesh sizzled and smoked, but Vincent did not stop. His flesh burned as he grappled with Napalm, wrapping his massive thick arms around the writhing fire creature. Steam billowed, and Vincent's shrill and very human voice was a long, drawn-out howl of rage, but he did not let go of the living volcano. Slowly, inexorably, screaming incoherent gibberish words, Mad Vincent dragged Napalm toward the water by the Okeanos's bow. For a heart-stopping moment, the two great monsters wrestled for control. Napalm sprang fire and roaring, Vincent screeching and pulling. Dekka felt like a mere human watching the gods battle. They smashed and battered each other. Napalm belched fire. Vincent's poisonous flails stung him again and again. And with each passing second, Vincent dragged Napalm another foot closer to the channel. Now Vincent's remaining meat puppets rushed at Napalm, slammed into his legs even as they burned, slapped him with their own tendrils, which curled like leaves in a fire. Then, with the majestic slowness of a falling redwood, both Vincent and Napalm fell backward, banged against the prow of the Okeanos, and tumbled into the water. Steam erupted in a geyser, searing Dekka and Armo, even as they backed hurriedly away. Malik was between Dekka and the ship. He had his back to Napalm and Vincent, was huddled protectively over Shade. He was talking to her. "It'll be okay, babe. I'm getting you out of here." The boiling cloud of steam rolled over him. Malik did not have a morph. He had no special power protecting him. He was an innocent bystander, a civilian wandering onto a brutal battlefield to protect the girl he loved. The steam rolled across his back. Blisters rose over the back of his thighs, his buttocks, his shoulders, his neck, the back of his head. Dekka saw his eyes widen in sudden realization. "Ah!" Malik screamed. An eerie, spine-tingling scream of unbearable agony. His mouth opened to scream again, but before a sound could come, he collapsed onto the dock. He thrust his left hand out to stop his fall, and his palm landed in liquid fire. His knees struck right at the edge of the creeping magma, and he tried to pull away, but he had lost the use of his left hand. Malik had taken the blast that would have cooked Cruz and maybe Shade as well. He shrieked again, an eerie animal howl, inhuman, like nothing Dekka had ever heard before, the sound of a person in more agony than the human mind could accept. Cruz jumped up and body-slammed Malik, knocking him clear of the fire, but too late, because a slab of Malik's skin sloughed and hung like a limp flag from the back of his neck. Shade had seen it all. She had been looking into Malik's eyes when the steam hit him. She forced herself to stand, feeling the effects of the poison weakening. She limped after Cruz, crying and demorphing. In Cruz's strong arms, Malik bellowed in pain, writhed and heaved. Cruz touched still-burning flesh and dropped Malik, and Shade tried to help her, tried to lift Malik, tried to ignore his terrified eyes, tried to gather him up, to hold him close, and somehow put out the flame that still chewed at his flesh. But her arms were too weak, too leaden. "Malik," Shade croaked. "Malik!" Cruz, summoning courage she did not imagine she possessed, lifted Malik into a fireman's carry, draping his arms over her shoulders, lifting his weight with her legs, ignoring the drops of burning human fat that fell onto her shoulders and neck. "Malik!" Shade cried. "Malik!" A morphed Armo came then and took Malik from the struggling Cruz, lifting Malik's weight as if he was a small child. "To that van!" Cruz panted, nodding exhaustedly toward the damaged van. She ran ahead and opened the back door, and Armo slid Malik in.
"Good luck," Armo said, and ran back to Deka.
Shade, feeling like a drunk, arms and legs working, but not well, slid into the driver's seat.
"Map, Cruz. Hospital."
Before Cruz could respond, Shade floored the accelerator and turned so sharply, the van was momentarily on just two wheels.
"Get him there alive," Shade told herself grimly. "Just get him there alive."
But driving was hard with numbed limbs and blurry vision and the howls of unspeakable agony behind her.
"St. Mary Medical Center," Cruz said. "Right at the 47. It's 7 miles. Malik, hold on, hold on. We're going to the hospital."
The van went tearing erratically through the port, weaving almost miraculously through a stream of LAPD cars all rushing the other way. The battle had drawn the curious, and traffic was dense as drivers slowed to gape at the pillar of smoke and the circling helicopters of the LAPD and three separate news stations. But now, Shade was morphing again, head clearer, awkward limbs stamping hard on the accelerator, and the world around her slowed. With complete indifference to the damage, she pushed through every gap, tearing off side mirrors, leaving great gouges in paintwork.
"I've killed Malik."
Perdido Beach, all over again. Her mother, and now Malik. If he somehow survived, he would never be the same. He would never be the beautiful boy she'd once loved. Still loved. 7 miles took them just 6 minutes. Shade pulled the van to the emergency entrance, leaped out, grabbed Malik's shoulders as Cruz grabbed his legs. They ran him inside, yelling, "Help him, help him!" The triage nurse stared in confusion. Shade pushed past, kicked open a swinging door, and found herself in the midst of chaos. Wounded police officers and dock workers, some horribly burned, some with blood-soaked bandages, and doctors and nurses with heads down rushing from patient to patient. There were no empty beds, so Shade and Cruz set Malik down on the counter of the nurse's station. An ER nurse yelled, "What the hell are..." before she saw Malik's condition, and then, as if someone had thrown a switch, she was rapping out orders and demands. A young doctor rushed up and began yelling his own instructions. Shade stood back, panting, human again.
"Is he going to die?"
Cruz asked, sobbing.
"I don't know," Shade said. "I don't know."
Now Malik was concealed by half a dozen doctors, nurses, and technicians. Needles plunged into veins. A tube was pushed down Malik's throat. Status reports came in rapid succession. Pulse, oxygen level, blood pressure.
"Is he allergic to anything?"
a nurse demanded.
"No," Shade said.
"Can you..."
"We're trying,"
the nurse snapped.
"You've killed him, Shade."
Cruz's flat statement was a knife in Shade's heart. Time froze as the awful reality became a new and insidious poison in her veins. The medical team lifted Malik onto a gurney, and, still surrounded by white coats, he was wheeled away. And Shade was left with Cruz. They stood side by side, looking stupidly at the swinging door through which Malik had disappeared.
"Pray,"
Shade said to Cruz. It was somewhere between an order and a plea.
"You believe in all that, so pray, okay? Pray."
"I am praying," Cruz said. And silently added, "For him, for you, for the whole human race." Chapter 27. Heroes, Villains, Monsters. Deka and Armo stood side by side, watching the huge mutant starfish struggle in the water, watching steam billow up, watching the surge of water splash up and over the dock. A new helicopter, much larger, was hovering, looking for a place to land that wasn't aflame. The Coast Guard cutter pumped futile cannon and machine gun rounds into the water.
"What do we do, bet on the outcome?"
Armo asked.
"If I had my old power, I could move that rock somewhere. Well, I was going to say safe, but what the hell does that even mean?"
Deka wondered. One of the meat puppets seemed to notice her, and the creepy human-starfish hybrid creature came at a run. Deka shredded it with barely a glance. But then, one of Vincent's legs slapped the dock,
and with its tubules began slowly, warily, it seemed to Decca, pulling itself all the way onto the dock. The Coast Guard ceased firing because a miss now might kill innocent civilians. Decca and Armo backed away, retreating faster and faster as the creature filled most of the parking lot, not quite as big as it had been since it had lost arms to both the densovirus and Napalm's Fury, and the regrowing sections were shorter. But it was still enormous, and the belt of poisonous tentacles still writhed and lashed, reaching out almost as far as the creature's red legs. And, like a model riding atop a nightmare vision of a parade float, Vincent Vu still emerged from the central circle at the nexus of the arms.
"We have a winner," Armo said bleakly.
"Yeah." Decca raised her hands and howled and... nothing. Too far away. Damn, I was sure hoping this worked from a distance. Vincent wrapped one thick leg around the mother rock and seemed almost to cuddle it. Behind them, the big new helicopter hovered a few feet above burning wreckage. The helicopter's door slid open, and Decca saw its main passenger.
"It's that nightmare guy," Decca said.
"Great. Now the freak show is complete."
Nightmare jumped down from the chopper, indifferent to the fact that one taloned foot landed on a charcoal corpse, crushing it to powder.
"Whose side is he on?" Armo wondered.
"Ours, for now," Decca said, pointing out that Nightmare stood facing Vincent, the long sword arm at the ready.
"You want to help him?" Armo asked.
"Do you?"
Justin Devere, a.k.a. Nightmare, had fought Shade Darby. He had murdered airline passengers in cold blood. He had torn the Golden Gate Bridge apart. None of that his fault. All of it simply necessary and thus forgivable. DeMarco had tortured and twisted him, had stuck her vile control devices in him and used electric shocks to force him to morph for her. But in his own mind, Justin was still an artist. His eyes still sought out the unique, the extreme, the shocking. Nothing in his experience had prepared him for what he now faced. It was, in its own way, a demented masterpiece. Something small and perhaps creepy, but not in any way frightening, had been turned into this creature that somehow combined absolute terror with an element of the comic. The thin brown kid was like something out of a cartoon, a weird, impossible blend of incompatible life forms conjured by alien artists working on a huge canvas. Justin swallowed in a dry throat. His mind yammered a running commentary, mostly consisting of places he could run away to, and curses directed at DeMarco. That and the phrase, "It's too big." The hated female voice came from a loudspeaker in the air, from the Sikorsky, which had risen to a safe 200 feet and now beat the air over their heads.
"Attack! Attack!"
the voice ordered. Justin sighed shakily. Attack, or DeMarco would send intolerable pain exploding through his body. Attack, or let DeMarco reduce him to helpless immobility, to be destroyed by the creature. But still, part of Justin's mind noted the color of the creature, admired the uncanny valley effect of a boy half-riding, half-absorbed into a creature that had never, could never, exist in the dull and predictable universe where Justin had lived his life. He had a vision of a painting, an abstract using that fantastic, unique red, and the oily black of the smoke, and the creature moved forward with surprising speed, mincing on delicate tubules like a centipede.
"Attack, Private! Attack!"
Justin spared a moment for self-pity. How had it come to this? Erin, dead, and now that she was gone, he missed her. She had never loved him, he'd known that. But at times, she had been kind. She had been all he had. Now, here he was, drafted into a fight he did not want. But the threat of pain was too compelling. He had no choice. Anyway, Justin told himself in a weak attempt at buttressing his ego.
"I am Nightmare, and Nightmare fears no one. Right?"
with a cry that was meant to be a roar, but came out as a frightened whimper, Justin ran straight at the nearest arm, swung his sword, and sliced effortlessly most of the way through where the arm was as thick as a sewer pipe. He grabbed the injured leg with his claw, pulling the deep gash wider, and swung his sword again. This time, the blade went all the way through to the concrete beneath, and a chunk as big as an elephant came away. Came away, but did not die. Rather, the detached leg instantly crawled at Justin, and he swung again, cutting a third of it away. This third, too, did not die.
"Hydra," Justin whispered.
He had paid very little attention to any part of school, but he had done a paper that referenced the Moreau painting, Hercules and the Lernaean Hydra. In Greek mythology, the Hydra was a beast with many heads, but if you chopped one off, another grew in its place.
"Go for the boy,"
DeMarco's voice, distorted by the loudspeaker and even more by the incessant whap-whap-whap of the helicopter. The boy was at the far end of a 50-foot arm and sitting easily 25 feet up.
"Sure, no problem," Justin said, gritting his teeth.
It would take speed, and once he started, he wouldn't be able to stop. All or nothing. He gathered his courage and broke into a run, straight at the beast. He jumped atop the nearest uncut leg and ran its length even as it curled up behind him like a trailing wave. Easy. In 2 seconds, he would cut the creepy kid in half. But as he swung his sword, the tentacles whipped at him, smearing his armor with caustic poison and worse, in the short term, entangling his legs so that Nightmare went sprawling. His outstretched sword arm stabbed right for Vincent, but three tendrils snatched at the blade, were cut through, but managed nevertheless to steer the blade harmlessly away. Nightmare jumped up, looked down, and saw smoking holes in his chitin armor. But the pain was distant, and the poison would never reach his bloodstream. He charged again, yelling, "Die! Die!" and swinging his blade like a scythe through the whipping worms, which sprayed poison like severed arteries pumping blood. At last, he was face to face with Vincent, only a few stubby tendrils whipped frantically between them.
"Who the hell are you?"
Nightmare roared. The boy had a surprisingly sweet smile and a musical voice. "I am Abaddon. I am the destroyer anointed by the god Satan. I am the star."
"You're batshit is what you are,"
Nightmare said, and prepared to slice the boy off the monster like a wart. "You haven't even figured it out, have you?" Vincent said, and it was his taunting voice that stayed Nightmare's sword.
"You don't even know what this is, do you, Nightmare? I guess you're stupid."
Justin gaped. This kid was taunting him, insulting him. He sounded like a not very bright high school bully.
"Stupid old Nightmare," Vincent said, voice dripping sarcasm. "You know nothing. You want me to tell you? Do you?"
Nightmare's great armored head nodded. Vincent held his frail human arms out, palms up, tilted his head back, and with a laugh in his voice, said, "It's all TV. It's all entertainment." Nightmare did not move, as the human brain of Justin Devere digested this statement.
"It's a show, you dumbass," Vincent said, "and you're just an actor."
Suddenly, the leg the bemused Nightmare stood on heaved so violently that it crumpled Nightmare's knees. He rose a dozen feet into the air, and like a baseball bat, a thick arm smashed into him sideways. Nightmare went flying, tumbling through the air, and skidded to a halt within a few feet of where Dekka and Armo stood. He raised his head, and, in a shadow of his usual ground-pounding rumble, said, "A little help?"
"You're garbage," Dekka snapped. "But I guess he's worse."
She glanced at Armo. "On three? Or some other number?" Armo nodded. "Three works." "Sword boy, you go around the back and start hacking. I'll try to get close to the center of the star and do my thing. And Armo?"
Armo nodded. "Berserk time."
Nightmare picked himself up, and Vincent, supremely confident, now that he had either killed or disabled Napalm, glided serenely past,
rolling over crushed vehicles and dead bodies.
One, Armo said.
Where's that Shay Darby person? Dekka demanded angrily. We could use her help.
Two, but whatever, Dekka said.
Three.
They were three, and on three, all three kicked off simultaneously. Dekka ran for the gap between the two nearest arms, howling and shredding as she went. Armo leaped atop a leg and launched himself, snarling toward Vincent's fragile form. Nightmare attacked from the back, swinging his sword arm with vicious strength, hacking and plunging and scything through arm and tendrils. Once again, Vincent merely jerked his muscles and knocked Nightmare to the ground. He swung two legs together, pinning Dekka, and now she was between two closing walls of flesh, shredding and sending up a tornado of fleshy bits. Armo was inches from burying his teeth in the smugly smiling boy. And then, a shadow behind him, a panicked glance, and the Mother Rock, wielded like a hammer, smashed down on Armo's back. In less than 60 seconds, the attack had failed, and a winded, battered, shaky threesome watched helplessly as the monster plowed toward the city, and the Dark Watchers writhed in glee. Vincent was on a manic high. He had battled the great fire-breathing napalm and left him broken in the mud of the channel. He had tossed Nightmare around like a toy. He'd had more trouble with Dekka. She had hurt him, and he suspected that the day would come when she would be a problem. But that day was not today. He could see her defeat in the weary droop of her shoulders. Armo, too, had been casually shrugged aside. Now what Vincent wanted was rest. The mania was softening, ebbing, and melancholy now tainted his great victories. The Dark Watchers loved him. He could feel it. He was the star. And wasn't that a nice pun? A starfish star? Ha! Five separated sections crawled beside him, a small but dangerous meat puppet army. He was unstoppable. He was the greatest power on Earth, and they loved him for it. He slithered across the parking lot, and with a negligent swipe of one leg, smashed the side of the main prison building. Crumbling masonry revealed shocked prisoners in khaki uniforms, some of whom promptly bolted. It gave Vincent an idea, though. He could create havoc by breaking open jails and prisons, like in that Batman movie. On the other hand, if you wanted to mess up Los Angeles, all you really had to do was create traffic jams, right? Did he want to mess up L.A.? Vincent hadn't really thought about the next step. In fact, he had no clear goal in mind, other than providing the Dark Watchers a delightful entertainment. He'd done that in spades, but what was next? Vincent understood his place in the emerging new world. He was a supervillain. The supervillain. Clearly. Okay, so what did supervillains do, exactly? Take over the world? What would he do with the world if he did take it over? That sounded like a complicated job, and he wasn't at all sure it was a job he wanted to do. It felt as if there would be math involved. The old voices were whispering to him. They no longer yelled as if they were cowed by the new force that had taken root in Vincent's scrambled brain. They reminded him that he was a Baddon, a dark angel, a destroyer of worlds. He could begin the work. He could kill and kill and kill. Vincent sat atop and at the center of the star, riding high. He had a clear, unobstructed view of the port around him, and he considered taking some time to annihilate the dozens of great cranes, smash the containers, sink the ships. All things he was sure he could do. But why? It was all much clearer when he was manic. When the mania passed, what followed was a passive, abstracted state that normally sent him to his bed to read or watch videos and eat snack food products. But now he was this great and powerful monster, a Baddon. And he was his puppets as well, seeing through their dim eyes when he chose, controlling them if he needed something from them, otherwise letting them follow like ducklings after their mother. He kept moving, then looked left and spotted the battleship Iowa. Long decommissioned, and now just a tourist destination, he slid into the water of the channel and found that he could sink or swim as he chose, walk across the muddy submerged bottom, or float
over the flat water. Destroying the battleship would be fun, at least. The Watchers would enjoy that, even if he took no joy in it himself. But then, coming up the channel was the Coast Guard cutter. The Beaufort's rounds had bruised him, but not done serious damage, exploding against the surprisingly tough outer skin. So he wasn't terribly worried to see the white ship. But the Coast Guard had learned. They had only a few armor-piercing shells on board, mostly to sink derelict ships that could not be salvaged. The first armor-piercing shell penetrated Vincent's skin before exploding. It was sharply painful and left a crater. Chunks of Vincent's body flew through the air, but even before they landed, he felt their separate, dull, subservient intelligences awaken. His puppets. Each shell would make more. On the other hand, Vincent was not at all sure what would happen if he, himself, the still human part of him, was hit. He submerged, cool water flowing over him, as if he was a submarine diving. His human form was the last part to go under. He'd already discovered that he did not need to breathe underwater, but something about it still made him nervous. The gray steel of the Iowa's hull was a wall ahead of him, the keel just a few feet out of the mud. Vincent slid two legs beneath the hull and pulled sharply. The Iowa tilted crazily, sending the stupidly brave folks who'd stayed around to watch tumbling across the deck. But when Vincent tried to break the ship, he found the hull still too strong. All he could really do was rock the great ship back and forth, which was not very exciting to see. Not really entertaining. Not at all what one expected of a Baden. Besides, after a week on the Okeanos, he was tired of ships and the sea. So he slithered up onto the far side of the channel, keeping the Iowa between himself and that stinging Beaufort's gun. Leaving the port, he rolled into and over a neighborhood of inexpensive two-story apartment blocks, smashing cars, knocking down stucco walls, and collapsing tile roofs. And that, at least, was entertaining because people came running out into the street, hopped into cars or fled on foot, sometimes only half-dressed. He broke power lines and gas lines with predictable results. Fires blossomed in his wake. He felt weary, though. Hollowed out. The voices whispered, and the watchers silently urged him on, but every movement was an effort now, and he came at last to a stop, planted in the midst of a residential neighborhood. People fled before him, and that was nice, but his energy was all gone. He wanted a rest. He wanted everyone out of his head. He needed to sleep. A brave homeowner fired at him with a handgun. Vincent barely noticed. The homeowner, out of bullets, dropped the gun, and fled. Three big Sikorsky helicopters were veering to get in front of him, looking for a place to fight him again. No more. Not now. And Vincent Vu began to change. The great red arms shriveled and shrank. The flails lay limp and curled up like doodlebugs. He was surprised when his feet, his own human feet, touched pavement. Sirens rose and fell. Red lights came rushing down the street. But when they came screeching up and leaped out with guns drawn, they found nothing but a frightened-looking kid. "Hey!" a cop shouted. "Get the hell out of here!" "Where should I go?" Vincent asked plaintively. "Go home, you damn fool! Don't you know it's the end of the world?" So Vincent did just that. He walked away, joined a crowd of rushing people, passed many more emergency vehicles, and finally found his way to the home his mother would never see again. His father greeted him with a hug. "Thank God you're okay. Do you have any idea what's happening down by the port?" Chapter 28. Consequences.
"Are you family?" the doctor asked Shade and Cruz.
"No, but..." Cruz began. "We're all the family he has here," Shade talked over her. "Everyone else is back in Chicago."
"You need to contact them," the doctor said,
and his expression was grim.
"We may be able to keep him alive for 24 hours.
Shade fell into a molded plastic chair. They were in a hectic corridor, weeping family members, gurneys preceded by shouts of, "Clear path, clear path!" doctors and nurses and people carrying iPads to take down health insurance information. 24 hours? The enormity of it threatened to overwhelm her. Cruz said,
Shade, I didn't mean what I said about it being your fault.
Yes, you did. Shade snapped.
You meant it because it's true. He's here because of me. He's burned because of me.
She slapped her chest with a clenched fist.
He's dying because of me.
She covered her face with her hands, wishing tears would come because that at least would be some kind of release. The doctor was still talking, explaining that they had given Malik painkillers, but that they were going to put him in a medically induced coma, because not even the strongest fruits of the opium flower could hold this pain at bay.
Can we see him? Cruz asked. The doctor, already heading away to his next emergency, waved a hand over his shoulder and said,
You won't like what you see.
I can't see him, Shade said.
You need to say goodbye to him, Cruz said.
It came out harder, more accusatory than she intended. Shade shook her head.
I saw her. I saw my mom in the body bag, and every night before I fall asleep, I don't want to be haunted by Malik, too.
Cruz knelt before her and took her hands, prying them away from Shade's face.
Honey, if you don't, you'll be sorry later.
How the hell could I be more sorry than I already am? Shade raged.
Well, I'm going, Cruz said.
She stood, feeling the after effects of adrenaline wearying her muscles. Malik was alone in a bed, his head slightly elevated. He was entwined in electronic leads and plastic tubes, one of which was down his throat. He was swathed like a mummy, with only a strangely undamaged left hand free. He trembled, every muscle in his body seeming to vibrate like a tuning fork. Pumped full of morphine, he was still conscious, with one eye open, staring through a gap in the white gauze. That eye looked at Cruz, stared at her from the bowels of hell.
Hey, Malik,
Cruz said softly, and then, with nothing useful to say, she asked a stupid question.
How are you?
Malik blinked, stared with feverish intensity, and with his free hand he made the universal sign for writing.
You want paper?
Blink, and a choked moan that might be a yes. The machine that breathed for him made a shushing sound. The digital readout over his head drew electric green lines, reducing his beating heart and his still firing neurons to abstractions. Cruz found a pad on the table, and after a fruitless search, ducked into the hallway to borrow a pen from a nurse. She placed the pen tenderly in Malik's hand and held the pad as firmly as she could. He was right-handed and writing with his left. The penmanship was never going to be good, and it was a barely legible scrawl. Cruz frowned at the paper.
It says rock, Shade said.
She had entered silently and now stood looking at Malik, her chest heaving. Tears ran down her cheeks.
What?
Cruz asked, turning the pad to see more clearly. Then, with a slow realization, she saw that the single word was indeed rock. It was as if Shade had read his mind.
It's the only way, Shade said dully.
He figured it out, same time I did. She managed a bleak smile. Of course he figured it out, of course. Shade moved closer to Malik. She laid her hand on the only exposed part of him and whispered,
I'm so sorry, Bunny. I'm so sorry.
Cruz had never heard Shade use a term of endearment for Malik.
Do you think you can swallow?
Shade asked him.
Blink.
A water bottle stood on the table, half drunk. Shade twisted the top off and pulled a baggie of gray powder from her pocket. She funneled the powder into the water and shook the bottle. The powder swirled. Shade put the bottle to Malik's mouth, pushing the main tube aside just enough. She spilled a gulp of the laced water into his mouth and watched as his throat convulsed in a gulp.
You can't go into a coma, Shade said.
Blink. I can stop them, but it will mean you'll be in pain. Another gulp of the rock water.
blink. A nurse burst in. What are you doing? He can't drink.
She snatched the bottle away and set it back on the table.
There'll be another nurse by in a few minutes. I have to go. I'm sorry, but the news says that
that thing is headed right for my home. My son is at home.
She left as quickly as she had come, and a minute later, the same nurse was standing beside Shade again.
I've got this, Cruz said. I'll give him the rest, and I'll stay with him.
She gripped Shade's arm. You're not needed here.
Shade nodded, numb with grief and roiled by self-loathing.
Go, Shade. Go and do what you can. This is sidekick work. You're the superhero.
The Dark Watcher seemed sullen, or perhaps exhausted, and they watched Shade's mind with only distant interest as she raced the van back to the port until she hit impassable traffic. She ran the rest of the way and found Dekka swinging her leg over her miraculously undamaged Kawasaki. Armo was waiting his turn.
Where is it? Shade buzzed, then slowed down to say, Where is it?
Dekka shook her head. Cops say it just disappeared, crawled into a neighborhood, shriveled, and poof.
He demorphed.
Yeah, most likely.
Shade demorphed as well, resuming her normal shape.
How's your friend? Dekka asked. Shade was panting, unable to slow her breathing or the pounding of her heart.
No, no way that monster just walked away. No way it still lived.
Hey, Dekka prodded. Your friend.
He'll live, Shade said, the words feeling like a lie, a betrayal.
He might live, but he would never again be Malik, and she would never be free of guilt for what she had done.
Dekka knew that look. She had seen it on Sam's face after bloody battles, and she knew that he had seen it on her face as well.
You have to let it go, Dekka said, knowing there was no way, no way at all, for the girl standing before her to do that.
I'm going to kill it.
The words grated. Shade's mouth twisted down, and tears filled her eyes again.
I'm going to kill it.
Dekka nodded wearily.
Well, maybe so.
You're Dekka Talent, Shade said, eyes blazing.
I know you. I know all about you.
I need your help.
I need you to help me. Help me. Help me kill that fucking thing.
Dekka waited patiently while Shade Darby, the girl who held her emotions under iron control, stopped screaming.
Listen to me, Dekka said. I know. I know exactly how you feel. Exactly. But honey, it's not one battle, it's a war.
She picked around in her saddlebags and came up with a piece of paper bag.
Damn, I don't have anything to write with.
Shade stared at her through burning eyes. Then she raked one fingernail down the inside of her arm, gouging the flesh. Blood seeped. She held her bloody arm out for Dekka, and Dekka touched her arm and used the blood to write on the paper bag.
Email.
Shade nodded dully.
There will be more, Dekka said. It's all going to hell now. There will be a lot more.
When it comes, reach out to me.
Yeah, Armo said. Me too.
He swung his leg over the back of the bike and settled in behind Dekka. Shade's face, which she had managed to form into a stiff mask, now collapsed. Her jaw quivered. In a strangled voice, she said,
How do you do this? How do you live with this?
Dekka started her engine, leaned toward Shade, put a hand on her trembling shoulder, and said,
Welcome to the phase, Shade Darby. Welcome to the phase.
She drove away, and Shade folded the blood-smeared paper. The White House, Office of the Press Secretary, for immediate release. Remarks by the President on events in Los Angeles. The Oval Office, 1:59 p.m., EDT. The President. Good evening, my fellow Americans. 5 years ago, we were confronted with a great mystery in the area around Perdido Beach, California. The existence of the Perdido Beach anomaly, the dome, and the effects on the unfortunate children trapped inside that dome were events far outside our understanding. These were disturbing events.
Yesterday, we saw events that are more disturbing still. I want to tell you what we know at this time. Fragments of the same meteorite that initiated the events at Perdido Beach are falling to Earth. Those fragments contain an alien virus, probably a deliberately engineered virus, which has the effect of causing extreme mutations in some of those who are exposed to it or who consume it. We all saw the video from Los Angeles. We mourn the terrible loss of life. At this time, we have 52 confirmed deaths, including the crew of the Okeanos Explorer. Many of the fallen were first responders, police, federal agents, and emergency medical personnel. These brave men and women went into harm's way to perform their duties and paid the ultimate price. We honor their sacrifice. This is a great and unprecedented challenge. But I want you to know that your government is responding. We are redoubling our ongoing efforts to understand this phenomenon. We have already appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars to explore countermeasures. But we will need more to cope with this unprecedented threat to our way of life. In light of yesterday's events, I am asking Congress for an immediate appropriation of $30 billion to study the causes and begin to find solutions. Let me be clear. That will not be the end of our efforts, but the beginning. At the start of World War II, the U.S. government launched the Manhattan Project to develop the atomic bomb. The threat we face now demands a similar level of commitment. Therefore, I am, by executive order, establishing a crash military program to give us the knowledge and the tools to fight back against this threat. And I call upon the world, not only our allies, our friends, but all nations, even those with which we have had differences, to work together. We stand on the brink. The threat we face is serious. The challenges we face are daunting, but we have no choice but to face up to our problems, to come together not only as a people, but as the human race, to work together, to face the danger squarely and not to give in to fear. Thank you, and God bless America. Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Hoover Building, Washington, D.C., for immediate release. FBI 10 Most Wanted. Vincent Vu, Thomas Peaks, Shade Darby, Deca Talent, Aristotle Adamo, a.k.a. Armo, Justin DeVere, a.k.a. Nightmare, Malik Tenerife, Hugo Rojas, a.k.a. Cruz, Drake Merwin, Francis Spector. Chapter 29, Aftermath. Shade Darby did not immediately return to the hospital. Instead, she drove aimlessly along the cracked and decaying freeways of Southern California. The car she drove was stolen. The money she spent for gas was stolen. The things she could not do formed a damning list that churned endlessly in her head. She could not bring back the dead. She could not go home. She could not undo what she had done to herself or to Cruz or to Malik. She pulled off to the side of the road and she wasn't sure where, and cried. The last time she had cried was 4 years earlier, and she had vowed then, well, she had vowed a revenge she had now failed to perform, an impossible revenge. In fact, she had screwed up everything. The proof was lying in a hospital, gritting his teeth against pain Shade could hardly imagine. Didn't want to imagine. Her friend, Cruz, was staying with Malik, having to watch him, to listen to his cries. She was staying in Morph, playing the part of nurse, and withstanding the insinuating attentions of the dark watchers for hour after hour. Sorry, Cruz. Sorry, Dad. Sorry, Malik. Sorry, Mom. Such a terrible long list of people to apologize to. If she spent the rest of her life groveling and crying, she would never be able to find... Find what, Shade Darby? Find what? Forgiveness? Redemption? No. Only one goal was attainable now. Only one. Revenge. As her tears dried, the other part of Shade, the cool observer, the analyst, what Cruz called the shark, slowly reemerged. What had happened had happened. What was done was done. The world was changing. The old order was dead or dying. The center, to quote the poem, was not holding. It was coming apart. And rough beasts, their hour come round at last, were already slouching toward Bethlehem to be born. Hero, villain, monster. She, Shay Darby, had power. It didn't matter anymore how it had happened, only that it was true. She had power, and the villains and monsters would have to be stopped. There was no other way forward for her, no escape from her fate. "I'm a hero, whether I like it or not," Shade said to no one but the steering wheel. "Just thought it would be less terrible." She wiped away her tears. She punched the address of the hospital into the GPS. She still had no idea where she was, and, dry-eyed, went to face Malik and Cruz and the consequences of playing superhero. Vincent Vu had been unable to stay home. It was quickly surrounded by the FBI. So he used two of his meat puppets to clear a home a few blocks away of its inhabitants. Now he sat on a couch that was not his, watching a much nicer television than he owned. He was watching video of himself, replaying his battle with napalm, going frame by frame to try to see the speed demon, and the one with snake hair, and the big white beast. Like a football player, watching tapes after the game. Abaddon was within him. The beautiful, powerful, devastating beast was him, Vincent. Sooner or later, the voices in his head warned him, Abaddon must be released again. Vincent figured the voices were right, but for now he was content to watch TV and eat the snack foods belonging to the three dead people lying at his feet. Tom Peaks had barely survived by demorphing at the last possible moment, as his fire was extinguished and his strength faded under the brutal assault of Abaddon. He felt the disappointment, even scorn, of the Dark Watchers. But once he was himself again, they were gone, replaced by his own demons. He had always been a decent swimmer, even made it onto his high school team for a while. He swam underwater as much as he could, surfacing to grab a lung full of air as the battle raged behind him. He made it to the far side of the channel and barely avoided Abaddon as the monster slunk by. But Abaddon had not seen him, or if he had, he'd ignored the wet, naked man panting on the dock. Peaks was less conspicuous than he would have been under normal circumstances. The area was full of panicky civilians, and a kind, if scandalized, woman offered him some of her husband's clothing. He took that gratefully, and then beat the woman unconscious with a lamp and cleaned out her purse. What should he do next? He wasn't at all sure, but in the back of his mind, a list was taking shape. A kill list. General DeMarco topped that list, followed by Decca Talent and Shade Darby. Napalm still lived within him, and napalm would be unleashed again when the time was right. Of that he had no doubt. The keys he'd found in the woman's purse belonged to the Toyota Corolla in her driveway. Peek saw that the tank was 3/4 full, more than enough to get the hell out of the area, find a peaceful place to hide, and plot what he was sure would be his ultimate revenge. The Royal Navy frigate Argyle raced south along the eastern coast of Isla. The very hungry caterpillar, now over 200 feet long, having fed on dozens of sheep, two horses, the contents of various homes and markets and taverns, as well as 19 humans, including his sister, had been spotted on the coast, just north of the Ardmore Distillery. The entire crew lined the rail, watching with mute awe at the great beast, contracting and releasing, contracting and releasing, as it moved along the top of a cliff. Action stations was called, and the crew rushed to their weapons. 10 minutes later, the Argyle opened up with everything it had, and the caterpillar, once a cranky, teething toddler named Sean, was blown apart. Flaming fragments fell down the cliff and into the water. in Islamabad, Pakistan, a creature who could turn men inside out, was engaged by Pakistani military. 23 Pakistani soldiers died, and the creature escaped. Just outside Moscow, at the Federal Biomedical Agency, three fragments of ASO2, which had been recovered on Isla by a hastily detailed Russian SFB agent posing as a tourist, led to frowns of concern at the CIA, where analysts studied satellite imagery of the FSB's biomedical agency campus aflame. In Evanston, Illinois, Professor Martin Darby, cleared of complicity in his daughter's actions, tracked the last two ASOs from a newly secure computer and passed along to General DeMarco the grim news that one rock would land in China and the other in northern Brazil. In the bowels of the ranch, work proceeded apace. The FBI were at the door. "We're looking for DECA talent," Special Agent Carlson said. "Well, she's not here." That exchange was repeated in various forms several times more before Agent Carlson and the other agents behind him and out in the street grudgingly walked away. Once they were gone and their cars had pulled away, DECA emerged from the closet where she and Armo had hidden. DECA sighed. "I'm so sorry to bring this down on you. I didn't have anywhere else to go." "Well, DECA, maybe it's time that I was your strong right arm instead of the other way around," Sam Temple said. This is Amanda Dolan. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Monster by Michael Grant. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Caitlin Guerin. Text copyright 2017 by Michael Grant. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.